newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press. Now, you remember Mrs. Sadie Smuggery.
Media Project is a half hour of commentary and analysis where we talk about decision making in newsrooms and some of the ethical challenges that confront journalists in this very difficult time for legacy media. I'm Rex Smith of the Upstate American, formerly editor of the Times Union, with a couple of colleagues here from the golden days of journalism. We have Judy Patrick, formerly editor of the Daily Gazette and former vice president of the New York Press Association. And we have Barbara Lombardo, formerly executive editor of the Saratogian and the Record of Troy. So let's figure out what we're going to do. Do you have anything in particular in mind, Judy, that you'd like to talk about?
You know, speaking of the golden age of journalism, I am so worried about the CBS News broadcast, and I'm really worried about 60 Minutes.
Apropos the decision of the new ownership to put in a Trump partisan as a sort of watchdog. We'll talk about that. Barbara Lombardo, what's on your mind today?
I was also interested in New York Times and New York Focus's investigation in which they collected 10,000 disciplinary records. Records of police agencies from around the state.
Great project and a really interesting marriage of legacy media and a new digital platform, which we can talk about. That's great. Well, I want to talk about sports.
Oh, no, really? Tennis anymore?
Not really. I just want to talk about the fact that I went to the U.S. Open. It was really great. Now, it's long in the rearview mirror as folks are listening to this, but I met my daughter there and we went to the quarterfinals and saw some great tennis. But what I want to talk about is, of course, the media side of that, and is the fact that the president attended the men's final, and people who run it, the folks who run the U.S. Open, the United States Tennis Association, asked, please, ESPN and ABC, who are airing the final, we don't want you to show bad audience reaction to the president. We expect you to not pay attention to that. And in fact, there wasn't much attention to that, right? If you look at what the crowd shot and what was posted on social media versus what was actually seen by the folks at home, you can see that there was no effort to show, but rather it would seem an effort to cover up the negative reaction to the president's presence. There were cheers, of course, but there was principally a negative reaction. And of course, folks are upset because his presence there delayed a lot of people by more than an hour and a half in some cases, from even getting through the door.
So right. I heard some people miss parts of the match.
Oh, yeah. A lot of it. A lot of the seats were empty when the match had to start, even though they started at a half hour late. So I just want to know, what do you think? Is this okay? I mean, after all, it is a sports event.
We're not going to ask you, Rex, whether you applauded or booed. I appreciate the argument that the focus is supposed to be on the sport itself, but he was there, I don't think, as a real tennis fan. He was there as making a public appearance. And so I think it's fair game, especially at this time. I think other media outlets did include, and I've seen footage of the booing, which was pretty intense. The fact that they asked for the coverage to be diluted in that way, I think it's wrong. But again, ESPN is primarily a sports network.
That did give me the creeps when they ask for something like that to cover up what's really happening at the event. That is troubling. But I think that little attention should have been paid to Trump either way, that the people are watching that tennis so that they can watch the game and watch the commentary about the game and not watch the president one way or the other. And that said, they should have showed both the positive and the negative reactions of the crowd. Minimally.
You know, it's interesting. We often talk about the importance of the sports report for many information consumers and the necessity of saying, you know, this really is news after all. There's stuff that really matters. These are multi-billion dollar enterprises. The winning checks for the men's and women's singles winners at the U.S. Open was $5 million. And so there are big financial consequences to what goes on there. And it's a business that ought to be covered. So it is an interesting. Can I just tell you a fun story many years ago.
Please do.
Can you resist? The Indianapolis Star had a state editor, a guy named Ernie Wilkinson, who often would get reports when he was a sports editor from correspondents around the state, because as the big statewide newspaper in the middle of the state, the Indianapolis Star would get all these little stringers that correspondents around would call in all the basketball games. And this is very important in Indiana. Basketball is a big deal, high school basketball there, the same way high school football is in Texas. And one day, this very reliable correspondent out in Carmel, Indiana, didn't call in the results to Ernie Wilkinson. And Ernie was quite concerned. And finally, deadline approached, and he ended up calling her. And she said, "Oh, I'm sorry, Ernie, I didn't call because they canceled the game." He said, "Oh, I see." And she said, "Yeah, when the tornado came through and blew off the roof, they said that they couldn't play it." And she, of course, hadn't believed that her role had anything to do with the news of what was going on.
The narrow focus of a sports person.
Absolutely.
And vice versa. That happens in... If you're focused on your beat.
Yep.
Wow.
Yep. Focus on your
beat.
That's
a cute story.
You know, while this may have just, we're talking about the U.S. Open, but I'm a little bit worried about how this may happen at other venues and on other occasions. I mean, is this just the first sign of what we're going to see is the media turning the cameras away when people are starting to criticize President Trump? I think it's more than just a sports story at this time, and I think it's something we all should be aware of. Do we censor ourselves when it comes to what happens to the public out in the public sphere?
Well, isn't that really the concern about the naming of a new ombudsperson, I guess we would call it, at CBS News, that there will be an ombudsman who will receive and evaluate any complaints of bias or other concerns involving CBS? And this person is a guy named Ken Weinstein, former chief executive of the Hudson Institute, which is a conservative think tank. He has been a very outspoken supporter of Donald Trump, has been a donor. And the question is, if this is what's going on inside CBS News, will there be? That's the question. You're raising self-censorship. What's going to happen to CBS News?
You know, things don't look that promising based on this guy's record and his positions on issues. That said, I would like to try to give the guy the benefit of the doubt to get started and naively hope that this is going to be somebody not trying to correct criticism, but trying to be honest as an ombudsman. Silly me.
This is very bad news for CBS because everybody, I know that every far-right person out there is going to start hammering him with complaints. Anybody can make a complaint. This is going to be more than a full-time job for him. And I have no doubt that he is going to check every single fact. And again, this will lead to self-censorship. And at the same time, we're hearing that Barry Weiss and the Free Press may actually be brought into CBS News to help run the place. So the fine, stellar reputation of this great news organization, which has had its problems, is gone away. I mean, I cannot see how it can survive.
It is true that 60 Minutes remains the leading news program on television, and indeed the leading television, I think I'm getting this right, the top-rated television program outside sports on broadcast television. So folks pay a lot of attention to what CBS News does. And if it is going to be self-censoring or it's going to have somebody inside who is basically telling reporters what they ought to be doing. And there's a question, too, about the other side of CBS, which is Paramount, the ownership. Are they going to be also subjected to his scrutiny? Because there could be major conflicts of interest with Paramount, where anything that they do on the business side, he could be raising questions
even
about.
I'm not that naive to think that's going to happen.
Of course, imagine that. But we need to watch this. And the fact is, so much of society is right now reacting in a way that is trying to preclude the wrath of Trump, I think. Perhaps that's what's going on in some of the cuts to editorial boards. You know, we certainly saw this where the Washington Post and the Los Angeles Times squelched planned editorials that would have endorsed Kamala Harris in the last election. And now it turns out that there are editorial boards being shut down, editorial voices being stopped, columnists at local newspapers who are being turned away. This seems to be a trend. It was the one that we just saw, I guess, the Arizona Republic, which is one of the largest papers still in the country, and certainly the most powerful voice in Arizona. They have given buyouts and laid off, or I guess I should say, given an access to the door for people who have had significant voices in the coverage and in the opinion pages.
Yeah, opinion journalists with a mainstream platform seem to be an endangered species. A lot of these very fine writers have moved to Substack, where they have to fight to build their audience back up again. I used to think that some of the best writing a newspaper produces are the columnists. They're smart, they're witty, they're fun to read. I mean, examples of great writing more than just the day-to-day reporting coverage. So it's a great loss for our industry. And the other thing is you're not seeing a new generation come up. You're seeing the people in their 50s, 60s, and 70s still out there writing, even if they're on Substack. But are we seeing the 30 and 40 and 50-year-olds rising up and finding a spot on
these
mainstream
pages? That's a great
question,
because you need people with institutional knowledge. And you certainly can be in your 30s and 40s and have gained that. People have started in their 20s. And that is, there's that big gap of who's coming in and who knows what's going on. And I agree with you about the opinion columns. I still like, for the people that are still left at the Washington Post writing opinions and analysis, that's one of the first things I like to turn to, because it's not just the news, but they present the news with context.
Yeah, but I have noticed a shift in the Washington Post opinion page and in their editorials. I still see good editorials, but every once in a while I say, oh, that's a Jeff Bezos editorial. He really wants this free trade kind of approach to the editorial page. And
Free markets. Not free trade, that would be anathema to Donald Trump now. That was the old Republican Party. Suddenly it's Donald Trump's party, and it's all about... But it's not really free markets, because after all, now the United States government owns 10% of Intel. So the market is tilted in that direction, right? And it's not free markets because we're trying to squelch some industries and encourage others. We're trying to help along the coal industry and the poor struggling oil industry.
And the pharmaceutical industry.
Yes, let's keep them going. But I think, to your point about the columnists, I think people often don't understand what the value of columnists is. You know, we've had these experiences. Well, I think when you were the editor of the Gazette, Judy, you're the one who probably decided to make Andrew Waite, now of WAMC, a Metropolitan columnist.
That was after my time. But again, one of the problems with columnists and op-eds is people who read the newspaper or consume it online do not understand the difference between that and regular news reporting. And one of the things that the Trust Project, you know, this nonprofit out of Washington, I think, that tries to encourage trust, increase credibility in our newspapers, is the fact that they encourage us to more appropriately label our content. And again, there's renewed calls for us to do a better job of labeling editorial content.
I think that's a fair criticism.
It sounds easily remedied, for sake.
In print, but online, less so. I think, you know, a little red kicker head at the top, you know, saying that this is op-ed. If you ask the average person, you know, what a newspaper is, they won't even know. But if you know what the difference between an op-ed and an editorial and regular news reporting, a lot of people just don't understand.
You know, in the early days of the American Republic, newspapers primarily were organs for opinion. There wasn't much straight news reporting. And I should say, in the middle of the 19th century, at the dawn of the Civil War and the creation of the Republican Party in 1856, newspapers existed primarily to support particular parties. I was the editor of a newspaper in Indiana called The Republican. And there was another newspaper in that county called The Democrat. And one of the things that set apart the Albany Morning Times, the predecessor of the Times Union, is when it was created in 1856, it was nonpartisan, which was very unusual for that time. And so partisanship is not unusual for newspapers. We perhaps have gone through this golden age when straightforward news reporting was the predominant source that for 70 or 80 years dominated the American media landscape. And now I wonder if we are in an era when that has faded, when it's just not going to exist anymore.
Or maybe we should just embrace it and just sell our newspapers to the right or the left, and to hell with the middle.
Well, we've talked many a time that it's really hard to reach people who aren't in your silo already.
So do you do that with, like, powerful investigative reporting? I mean, I think this is a good moment to talk about this investigative exercise that you raised, Barbara, that the 10,000 police disciplinary records gathered by the New York Times and New York Focus, New York Focus Online, nonprofit news organization, disclosure statement I'm on the board of, And I think that this is a really interesting example of maybe the kind of reporting that might speak to both left and right.
I think so. And this took a couple of years at least to gather this information, maybe more. It contains information from 235 departments, according to a report on this story. They had 8,000 sworn officers who were included in this. So that's a lot. And we're not bringing this up as a great thing to pick on police or to be anti-police at all, but to say police, like other members of local government, are there to serve the public. And part of that is the public knowing what's going on with them. And you shouldn't have to fight tooth and nail to get information. You know, so some of the question becomes, now they've got the information and, you know, what are they going to do with it? How are they going to report it?
Yeah, in full disclosure, I am working with New York Focus to try to get their content in more local newspapers. And I think this is a classic example of a story that would work well in a lot of the newspapers across upstate New York because it deals with local police departments. The other thing we should mention is the fact that this did take a long, long time and a lot of effort in conjunction with the New York Times, and they got a special grant to do it. And at the end of the day, it's not a comprehensive list. There are still many, many police departments that did not comply, but we got enough of a sampling here to understand that there are times when municipalities will just turn, you know, a blind eye to police problems. I mean, we here in the Capital District, we have tried relentlessly as newspapers to try to find out that kind of information. And despite the passage of this legislation, this 50A legislation, it is still difficult, as New York Focus has illustrated, to get this information easily.
Well, so one of the least cooperative was the New York State Police, according to the story. And that state police, the people who are going to be serving a lot of New York State, where people don't have their local police departments. They might have and their sheriff's departments. One of the things that was brought up in this report was that there is no consistency on how reports of police misconduct are handled. So that's a general question that deserved to be answered and that should be of interest statewide. And then looking at your local, does your local police department have a process for filing complaints? And then how do they handle them? How do they pursue them? How do they report on them? And I had a lawsuit against the city a few years back concerning questions about excessive force in Saratoga Springs.
Yeah.
And which we settled, and they did provide information about excessive force reports, because at first they didn't want to provide any if they determined that it was an unfounded report. This has happened statewide. They won't provide the information about it. And that was part of the legal pursuit, was that, yes, you do have to present, you can redact the heck out of it, but you still have to tell people that a complaint was filed, it was investigated, and here was the finding at the end.
Because if the police department just says, no, there was nothing to it, how do you be an effective watchdog on that if they can withhold anything that they had, which was their intent?
Right. Or they say they were investigating something and it turns out they never did.
You know, this was a brilliant example of reporters being stymied about getting information, and they found a great workaround. They went to the district attorneys. I mean, they weren't getting it from the police agencies, and they realized someone figured this out, and that is how they got a great deal of the information that, at the end of the day, provided the basis of the stories.
This shows how that is what reporters often have to do. Good journalists will go around roadblocks and find another way to get information. This happens all the time, and folks don't understand how often that kind of a workaround is needed to get the information that just becomes a regular story. I think the other thing that this shows, this is a great example, perhaps, of a model for the future of collaboration being the way that we're able to get content now delivered to a local area. Imagine if major news organizations like the New York Times, the New York Focus, and others were able to compile data that could then be mined by individual journalists in localities around the state. Because if you are now a reporter, let's say you're working for the Saratogian and there's a very small staff on the ground in Saratoga Springs now, no one there is going to have time to actually pursue police misconduct documents the way you did some years ago, Barbara. But if they have the data in front of them gathered by a statewide powerful news organization, they can then interpret it and write local stories based upon it. So maybe this is something that will help our information-starved local economies.
Yeah, Gannett was a bit ahead of the curve on this. In Rochester, they started that kind of a database, and they were collecting information, and they were sharing what they were finding.
And it was statewide.
Yes, it was statewide. It was really good.
Mm-hmm. Right. It's not there anymore.
Oh.
This is the Media Project from Northeast Public Radio. If you want to have your voice heard, media at wamc.org is how you can reach us. And we are always glad to hear from you. I'm Rex Smith here with Barbara Lombardo and Judy Patrick. And we are talking about what's going on in journalism these days. I wanted to make note of something that's really interesting that I've always thought is a great opportunity for local media, but we've never quite been able to capitalize upon it in anything other than television. And that is weather forecasts. 60% of people in the United States check their local weather forecasts at least once a day, according to a...
What percentage is that?
60.
60 that don't have a window.
And, you know, television has always capitalized upon this. Weather is essentially important when the local cable operation, which has gone under many different names, but I guess now we call it Spectrum, when they first launched their local news operation, the news director said to me, the fundamental information we're delivering here is weather. And they were giving us weather on the nines or something like that, it was called. And that was the fundamental marketing opportunity for them. And in the newspaper world, we never managed very well to turn that into something. I don't quite understand why that hasn't been important for our beats.
Again, we used to make fun of the people who got stuck with the weather stories.
Speak for yourself.
But I found doing climate stories was really a rich area to go into. I mean, droughts affecting farmers, you know, water supplies going down. You find that when people are unable to water their lawns, they become interested in what's going on with the water table. So there are those, but again, I think at the local level, there's no time for those stories anymore, or is there any appetite for them? I definitely think there is, and in my time looking at analytics on a webpage, those weather stories get read.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I think that we would underestimate the interest in weather among the citizenry. We in the mainstream media ought to be giving more attention to this for the listeners and the readers. We cover it as a breaking news story. Oh, there's flooding here, or there's drought there. There's a tornado came through our town, whatever. And then we go on to our next thing. We don't really have a beat. This article was talking about having a weather beat, which makes sense, or at least it could be part of someone's broader beat and taking it by issue.
Certainly as extreme weather becomes more common and more costly, you would think that local residents could have more questions that they're going to need to be answered about safety, about infrastructure, about accountability. And those kinds of questions ought to be a great beat for any local news organization.
Because people are interested in it. So if there's a story in Saratoga Springs is having a voluntary watering ban or every other day or whatever it might be, then the better story tells that, but also how's the reservoir doing in Saratoga Springs and what's the future outlook and what are they doing to make sure that we have enough water?
These are easy stories to do. I mean, there are experts out there that are easily accessible that have been ignored for so long. They love getting the calls and they will return your calls. We have a great weather atmospheric science study at UAlbany close by, but the National Weather Service has great. So at least they do right now. I'm not sure what the outlook is, but there used to be great climate scientists that were very easily accessible.
But I can't think, when I saw that story, I was saying, oh, wouldn't that be great to have someone who's an expert on this come and talk to us on the Media Project? But I don't really know anybody who has the weather as a beat. There's meteorologists on TV, and are they covering?
No.
Maybe they're just reporting on
exactly
what's
the problem.
Radar. And
yes, that's exactly the problem. They're focused on the forecast rather than the broader picture. They're not giving us the understanding of what's behind the weather or whether the climate change. They're afraid to talk about climate change because Donald Trump says it's a Chinese hoax. Honestly, I think that's a big reason why you don't have better climate coverage coming out of local television stations, because they're worried about getting the Trump supporters upset by talking about something other than, well, here comes the next weather front. And that's an abrogation of responsibility that is, I'm sorry, endemic in local television news. So it ought to be done better. It's not only that folks in the, let's say, text-based news, that's what we, I guess, ought to call newspapers, ought to be doing more of that. But certainly television has the opportunity because they have trained meteorologists on staff, and those trained meteorologists ought to be assigned to doing more of this kind of coverage.
And these guys are trusted. I mean, they're well-known in the community, well-trusted, and recognizable. It is a lost opportunity.
Maybe we'll hear from somebody listening.
Maybe we will.
Come on. Have at us.
Well, we are out of time, unfortunately, for this week's show because it's been a rollicking fun conversation. We are grateful, folks, that you tuned in. We appreciate our producer, Dave Gustina, for making this all possible. I am Rex Smith here with Barbara Lombardo and Judy Patrick. Thank you for joining us. We hope to see you again next week on The Media Project.
Now, newspapermen are such interesting people. They used to work like hell just for romance. But finally, the movies notwithstanding, they all got tired of patches on their pants. They organized a union to get a living wage. They joined with other actors upon a living stage. Now newspapermen are such interesting people. When they know they've got a people's fight to wage. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, newspaper guild, got a free new world to build. Meet the people, that's a thrill, all together fits the bill. Oh, newspapermen are such interesting people. It's wonderful.
The Media Project is a national production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio. This week's projectors include former Times Union editor and current Upstate American Substack columnist Rex Smith, Judy Patrick, Vice President for Editorial Development for the New York Press Association and former editor of the Daily Gazette, and Barbara Lombardo, adjunct professor at the University at Albany and former editor of the Saratogian. You can listen to The Media Project anytime at WAMCpodcast.org or anywhere you get your podcasts. I'm your producer, David Gustina. Thanks for listening.
Startled poor old Sadie's on ting-a-ling-a-ling city desk. Hold the press, extra, extra, read all about it. It's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. Like the richest girl who could not bake a cake. Ting-a-ling, ting-a-ling, ling-a-ling-a-ling. Now, newspapermen are such interesting people. They used to work like hell just for romance. But finally, the movies notwithstanding, they all got tired of patches on their pants. They organized a union to get a living wage. They joined with other actors upon a living stage. Now newspapermen are such interesting people. When they know they've got a people's fight to wage. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, newspaper guild, got a free new world to build. Meet the people, that's a thrill, all together fits the bill. Oh, newspapermen are such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the guild. Now, publishers are such interesting people. Their policy's an acrobatic thing. They claim to represent the common people. It's funny, Wall Street never has complained. Ah, but publishers have worries, for publishers must go to working folks for readers and to big shots for their dough. Now publishers are such interesting people. It could be prostitution, I don't know. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, circulation, ting-a-ling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give three cheers for freedom of the press.